So 1 Corinthians chapter 7, which is on page 1148, starting with verse 7, which reads, I wish that all men were as I am, but each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. And then moving on to verse 17, I'm reading to 24. Nevertheless, each one should retain the place in life that the Lord assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is the rule I lay down in all the churches. Was a man already circumcised when he was called? He should not become uncircumcised. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called? He should not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts. Each one should remain in the situation which he was in when God called him. Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you, although if you can gain your freedom, do so. For he who was a slave when he was called by the Lord is the Lord's freedman. Similarly, he who was a free man when he was called is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brothers, each man, as responsible to God, should remain in the situation God called him to. This is the word of the Lord.
Good evening. What on earth does circumcision and slavery have to do with finding God's way as a married person? There are some concerned-looking faces around the room, but bear with me. Before we do any of that, is anyone here a cyclist? Raise your hand if you are. If you cycle regularly in London. Now, as everyone else looks around the room, you'll see their slightly smug-looking group of a healthy glow to them. Now, I am, or I've recently become once again, a London cyclist. And I have to say, it's been good for me in so many ways, but it's not been good for parts of my Christian walk. Because I have to say, raise your hands again if you're a cyclist. Keep your hand raised if, while cycling along Peckham Rye, you've nearly killed or been killed by a pedestrian. Yeah, there you go, that's all of you. Brilliant. So there's this thing when you're on a bike, for some reason people just don't see you on Peckham Rye and many other places in London as well. And cars pull out in front of you and don't give you enough space when they whiz past. And being a cyclist, to be honest, it's a complete nightmare. You're treated like dirt. I have to say, I'm also a pedestrian quite a lot of my time in London. And as a pedestrian, I get really wound up by cyclists. They completely do my nuts. Sometimes they go on the pavement, they cut corners, they dive past you, don't give you enough space, and quite frankly, they're really rude. But not as rude as car drivers when I'm on my bike, who are a complete nightmare. Mind you, I also do drive in London quite a lot. And I was driving back last week from somewhere or other, driving through London to get back to Peckham. And I swear to you, a man ran out in front of me while I was in a 30 zone doing 30, no more and no less, with a few metres to spare, and did this. I don't know if it was kind of saying extreme road crossing or whether he was somehow hoping that would stop the car. I didn't hit him, you'll be pleased to know, and I was equally pleased. But pedestrians, what a complete and utter nightmare. Perspective is a funny thing, isn't it? And I have to hold my hands up in all three cases and say I am a hypocrite. I've done things as a driver in the car that would annoy me as a cyclist seeing a car. I've done things as a pedestrian that would annoy me as a cyclist. And every time I sit there and fume to myself saying, oh, some people, they don't understand. And yet I'll do the same thing when driving as other drivers do, and that annoys me. And I'll think, well, I've got a good reason to do it. So why can't they understand? Why are they getting annoyed with me? Perspective is a really funny thing. And as we come to the issue of finding God's way as a married person, actually, I have to say, perspective plays a huge part. And as a single person, I thought married people often didn't understand what my life was like. And as a married person often thinks some single people don't understand the challenges. And having been both, I can hold my hands up and say I'm a complete hypocrite and often don't see things from a proper perspective. So as we begin to look at finding God's way as a married person, let's bear in mind that imagery. That actually we all come with our own history, our own perspective, our own points of view. And I'm aware it's not a straightforward issue, and it's one that often carries a huge amount of pain. Jenny, in her sermon last week on finding God's way as a single person, which she subtitled A Life Less Ordinary. I thought about calling this week A Life More Ordinary, but decided to back away from it. But she raised a really fascinating point, I thought. She looked at the Book of Ruth, and she was saying, rather than picking the end of the Book of Ruth with a happy ending, or the start when the plot starts out, she picked what she referred to as the complicated middle of the book. And she said, we all live in the complicated middle. None of our lives are sorted. None of our ways all work out. We are all operating, seeking God and seeking his heart and seeking his fullness. With our own hurts, our own wounds, we're all living in the midst of the complicated middle. So, marriage. I do feel here somewhat like I'm type roping over a vat of boiling oil, in that I'm aware it's an issue which has all sorts of strings attached to it. I've no doubt there are people in the room for whom it's been a painful issue in all sorts of ways. Perhaps you're single, and the last thing that you want to face on your Sunday evening is a smug married person going on about how great or how awful marriage may or may not be. Or perhaps you're married and actually you're having a really rubbish time in your marriage at the moment. It's really hard going. And perhaps the last thing you want is someone saying to you one more time, well, all marriages have their challenges. And if one more person says that to you, you're going to push them into that vat of aforementioned boiling oil and say, "Arr!" Or it may be that actually you've been married in the past, or you've known people who've been married and got split up, and you've been really, really hurt by it. And you still carry the scars of marriage when marriage doesn't work out, when it hurts, when it fails, when it leaves wounds. Wherever you're at, I'm not going to pretend I understand what you've been through or your situation or your perspective, but I hope and pray that as we go through this tonight and we think about what's it mean to find God's way, what's finding God's way look like, whatever circumstances we're in, that actually God will be speaking to us, challenging us and encouraging us in our walks of life, wherever we're at. Now, I imagine that most of you will have been to at least one church wedding. Let's have another show of hands if you've been to at least one church wedding. Okay, that's most of you. Now, at this wedding, I imagine you'll probably have heard a talk on marriage. Now, this talk, it may have been absolutely incredibly brilliant, or it may have been cringeworthily awful. But the point is this. It would probably have been built around one of three passages. Either it would have been built around Ecclesiastes, the famous bit that a cord of three strands is not easily broken. You've heard that one? Yep, a few of you nodding. Or it would have been built around the amazing 1 Corinthians 13 passage about what love is. Love that costs, but love that is so wonderful. Or it may have been built about one of the John's many references to love, where he goes love and love and love and love and love over and over again. The preacher will probably have spoken about the challenges and joys of marriage. And they would have stated the point that marriage involves putting the other and their needs before your own needs and yourself. They probably would have noted that this can be hard work. They may have referenced the significance of commitment and the fact that a marriage cannot be sustained by feelings or mere romantic sentiment. They may have gone on about the significance of marriage and the picture of Christ and his church, that when marriage is right, when marriage is good, it echoes God's relationship with us, and it can be the most beautiful thing. Now, all this is, of course, entirely true. And this stuff shouldn't come as a surprise to us, because if it's true for married couples that they're meant to seek the other before themselves, it's also true for every single one of us as a Christian. It's part of all of our calling. God told us to love one another as ourselves. Be this person our friend, our enemy, or even our relative. We are all called to love others in a sacrificial way. All of us. It's just that in the context of marriage, this can be really intense. There's no downtime to get away from the person, to prepare yourself to be Christian again, so you can face the next conversation. If your marriage is going to be to last and be fruitful, and if someone's going to find God's way as a married person, they need to be prepared for this and willing to work at it, to acknowledge their mistakes, and to seek God's freely given gifts to help them with it all, in all the mess and confusion that can be life. As Jenny stressed last week, we all live in the complicated middle of the book. So because we're all by now probably aware of the familiar wedding sermon, rather than looking at the fact that marriage involves putting the other before yourself, rather than looking at the fact it involves compromise, involves trust, etc., as true as all these things are, I want to build on Jenny's sermon last week by unpacking some principles for finding God's way. And yes, these will apply to married people, but also hopefully to those who are single, engaged, going out, or indeed even for those for whom, as Facebook so elegantly phrases it, it's complicated. So let's turn to that 1 Corinthians passage to find what Paul's answers are. Now, Paul here seems to be answering a series of complicated questions that the Corinthian church have asked him about sex and marriage and singleness and what's best and what the best outcomes are. But rather than focusing on his answers to questions around marriage, we're going to focus in the middle section of this question and answer, which appears to be not about marriage at all, but about circumcision and slaves. So let's start off with a section which in your Bibles is sandwiched between two sections which in my translation have been given the somewhat grand headings of concerning married life and concerning the unmarried. So this is sandwiched in the middle. And it starts out, verse 17, "Nevertheless, each person should live as a believer in whatever situation the Lord has assigned to them, just as God has called them. This is the rule I lay down in all the churches. Was a man already circumcised when he was called? He should not become uncircumcised. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called? He should not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts. Each person should remain in the situation they were in when God called them." So here Paul lays out the first of two case studies about how we can live our lives as God has called us. Or perhaps we could say one of two case studies about finding God's way in our circumstances. So first off, Paul lays down this rule which he says he set out across all the churches he's working in. If someone is circumcised when they become a Christian, they don't need to go and get uncircumcised. If that's a thing, it's a bit of a complicated procedure, one imagines. Or if someone's uncircumcised when they become a Christian, they don't need to go and get circumcised. Now, fair enough, you may think, that sounds like fairly obvious advice. It's certainly advice that I'm going to hold on to. But what we have to remember was the issue of whether or not Christians should be circumcised was the first divisive issue in the early church. This was the thing that nearly split the church right at the start. This was a major theological concern. You'll know that in the Old Testament, circumcision is a sign given from God to Abraham that he is going to be a promised person, his descendants are going to be a promised people. Circumcision is of real significance to the people of Israel. But as Christianity begins to spread outside of the Jewish people, then they find themselves reaching non-Jews. And of course, non-Jews aren't circumcised. Now, this all gets somewhat confused because this message that Jesus has is all about a new promise, a new covenant, we might say. So do the people who've become Christians, they need to be part of the old covenant? Do they need to be circumcised to tick that box? Or do they not need to be circumcised? Can they stay as they are? And what Paul realised far sooner than many other people was the problem is if you make people get circumcised, if you make them add something onto their new relationship with Jesus, then you've added legalism, you've added a rule and a regulation to what is a freely given gift. So Paul says again and again in his letters, this isn't the gospel plus something else. This isn't Jesus offers us a free gift of life in all its fullness and relationship with him and to be part of his kingdom and eternal life. But he also requires this. He says, look, it's the gospel and nothing else. And so Paul argues again and again that people who aren't circumcised don't need to get circumcised. But this is a really divisive issue, and people are arguing the case on both sides. So when Paul writes this passage, his explanation is as brilliant as it is simple. He says, if you are circumcised, great. If you're not circumcised, great. Stay as you are. Because of Jesus, this doesn't matter anymore. Fix your eyes on him. Live his way. Live out his calling. That's what matters. Guys, it's not your circumcision which gives you your identity as a Christian. It's not your circumcision or your uncircumcision that defines who you are. You are defined. You are set apart by your relationship with God. That's what matters. So next, Paul tackles on the second half of the reading we had to talk about slavery. He says, were you a slave, this is verse 21, were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you. Although if you can give your freedom, can gain your freedom, do so. For the one who was a slave when called to faith is the Lord, in the Lord, is the Lord's freed person. Similarly, the one who was free when called is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of human beings. Brothers and sisters, each person, as responsible to God, should remain in the situation they were in when God called them. So what's going on here? Is this passage, is Paul saying here, as for so many years people argued for their own benefit, that slavery is absolutely okay and people should stay in a condition of slavery? No, he's not. The Bible's clear throughout that slavery is an evil. Actually, it's not okay. But slavery was prevalent in the Roman Empire at the time when Paul is writing. And what he's saying to those who find themselves as slaves and then become Christians is this. You are no less significant as a follower of Jesus because you are a slave. Your identity is not in the fact that you're a slave or you're a freedman or you're a Roman citizen, which was the badge that everyone wanted to get, the kind of shopping at Waitrose badge of you've made it in society. That's what everyone was going for. He says, look, it doesn't matter. He's not saying that being a slave wasn't hard. He's not saying that being a slave wasn't rubbish. He's not saying that slavery wasn't an evil. But what he is saying is this. Look, guys, if you find yourself in slavery, if you get offered your freedom, then seize it. That's great. Seize it with all you are, because freedom is a good thing, a thing that comes from God. But, and here's the but, if you spend all your time as a Christian dreaming about better circumstances, if you spend all your time daydreaming and fantasizing, if only I was free, then I'd be content. If only I could not be a slave anymore, and then I could really do it for Jesus. If only I wasn't in that situation, then I'd worship God fully. Paul says, the problem is if you live like that, you'll miss out on all that God has for you in the here and now. You'll miss out on all the gifts that he has for you, and you'll miss out for all he's going to use you for in the circumstances you find yourself in. Yes, it's not necessarily a good thing that you're a slave, but actually, God can use you where you are, and you're no less significant for your badge of being a slave. In the same way, you'd be no more significant to God if you were a Roman citizen or a freed person. Actually, in God's kingdom, we're all equal. It's not about our circumstances. And though we may seek different circumstances, then that's not a bad thing. But actually, we're not defined, we're not tied down to what our circumstances are, whether we're circumcised or not, whether we're a slave or whether we are free. So what does all this have to do with marriage? When I was in my late teens, I wanted to be a missionary in Asia. I'd grown up reading all the great missionary biographies, and I travelled a bit, and I thought that's That's what I want to do. So I imagined myself there, Tim Armstrong, the grand missionary, hacking through jungles, preaching the gospel, and seeing people turn en masse to Jesus as their Lord and Saviour. And I thought to myself, how much easier it will be when I leave school and get away from this godless nation who have turned their backs on God. And then I'll be able to tell people about Jesus. And then I'll be able to really live for God. When I was 18, I spent about 3 and a bit months living out in Nepal in Asia. And I thought to myself, how much easier it will be when I'm surrounded by people who speak my language. I don't have all these complicated cross-cultural misunderstandings. And then I'll be able to tell people about Jesus. And then I'll be able to really, really, really live for him. We can live out our whole lives believing that we are defined by our circumstances. That if only I can get here, then I'll really be able to live for God. If only I was circumcised, then I would be content and I could really live out God's calling. If only I were free, I would be content and I could really live out God's way. If only I were married, then I would be content. And then together we could really live out God's calling on our lives. If only I were single, this isn't my own thought by the way, if only I were single and didn't have all these commitments, then I would really be able to give God my everything, but as it is, I just have to get by. Finding God's way isn't about wishing our circumstances were different. Although if you are a slave, there is nothing wrong with seizing your freedom if it's offered to you. And if you are single, there's absolutely nothing wrong with looking for someone to marry. But always remember that marriage isn't better than singleness, and singleness isn't better than marriage. This is a mistake the church has made repeatedly over the past 2,000 years. And if you ever feel that we've given you the impression that that married people have more status or are somehow more important or better in leadership than single people, or vice versa, then forgive us, because we've sinned and we've fallen into an age-old trap. The Romans had all sorts of discussion in their philosophical circles about some thought being single is the obvious better way to be, because then this kind of the ascetic people, the Stoics often, and then you wouldn't be tied down by all these commitments and all these other things, and you could focus on really being a good, noble and true citizen. And then other segments of society would argue, oh no, marriage is the highest calling, because marriage is where you can produce offspring and have a family, and the church over the years have fallen into the same trap. From the medieval Catholic Church, which said, oh no, single people have the highest status, misinterpreting a verse from Paul we'll come to in a minute. Oh no, it's only single people who can join the priesthood, because they're the only ones who can really commit to knowing God. Right through to the Reformation, where the Protestant and especially the Puritan movements venerated marriage as kind of the better way. If you're not married, then perhaps you're not as important. Both these perspectives are wrong, and they're not godly. Be content. Find God's way. He is calling you as you are in your current circumstances. He's calling you to live out his ways. It's not always easy. There will definitely be pain and tears, but there will also be life, and life in all its fullness. Have a moan to God about your circumstances. Tell him about your hopes and your dreams, because he can take it. He can take it. But live in the here and now. Live out his calling. Find God's way. So after all that background, what does it mean for those of us who are married or who may one day be married? What does it look like for us to find God's way as married people? And to find out, let's jump back a few verses to 1 Corinthians 7, verse 7, for Paul's perspective. And Paul was, he was either a bachelor or a widower, we don't know for sure, but we know that he was single. And he wrote this: I wish that all of you were as I am. some would say quite a vain thing to say, some would say quite presumptuous, but he's saying in the sense that I wish all of you were single. Paul, on some level, wishes everyone could remain single, not because it's a better or a higher calling or anything like that, but because it's a certain reality that that when you only have responsibility for yourself, you are, to some extent, more free to put your time and energies into giving God your all. But Paul is also very clear that marriage is not inferior to singleness, or vice versa. It just has a different challenge attached to it. So marry people or those who may get married. Finding God's way may have more added complications for you, as you have a duty of care to one another. Everything in those wedding speeches that you have heard, the wedding talks, is true. Marriage does involve putting the other person before yourself. To quote very loosely the Bible, as well as a popular Spice Girls single, two have become one. And so the calling for you has no longer become your two individual callings. It's become your calling together. Actually, what does God's walking with God look like in your life? It's not simple, it's not straightforward. It doesn't mean that you have to do the same thing all the time or anything like that. It doesn't mean you need to do the same ministries or volunteer for the same things. So I know some people who just dread that idea with all their souls. But it does mean actually you need to be praying together, you need to be reading the Bible together and making time to seek what God's heart is and asking, what's it look for us? What's it look like for us to serve God with all we are? What's it look like to serve God as who I am, who we are in the circumstances we find ourselves in? Finally, the second half of verse 7, Paul says this: but each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Paul here is talking actually about a God-given gift in the midst of either the single state or the married state or everything in between. Actually, what he's saying is God will give us the gifting, God will help us, whatever our circumstances, to thrash out and to work out what it means to find his way. Now, you'll know if you're familiar with the letter to the Corinthians that one of the big issues in them, one of the things the Corinthian church was really obsessed with, was what they like to call spiritual gifts. Gifts that make one look spiritual. And Paul turns this concept on its head when he writes back to them, and instead changes the word he uses from being spiritual gifts to being charisma. And charisma, which I know has a modern usage as well, but charisma in the Greek means a gift that's freely given. A gift with no strings attached, a gift that you can't take any credit for earning. And what here Paul's saying about marriage or singleness is, whatever your state, whatever your circumstance, whether you're married or whether you're single, whether you've been really wounded by marriage or whether you're really it's something that you'd love to get to and you're not there, actually God says, do you know what, come to me and I will gift you, I will give you the gifting freely and utterly, to be my person, to find my way in the situation you are in. So whoever you are, whatever stage of life you're at, whatever hurt you're carrying, whether you're married, single, or as Facebook says, it's complicated, find God's way, live God's way, love God's way, and you will find life. Amen.